Huntsville, Texas, death penalty capital of the Western world, where prison staff is preparing to put Garza to death by injecting him with a deliberate drug overdose. During the next hour, KPFT's Execution Watch will broadcast live coverage of the killing in Texas, the state responsible for more than a third of all U.S. executions. Execution Watch host Marlo Blue, legal analyst Jim Skelton, with criminal defense attorneys Susan Ashley, Larry Douglas, Mike Gillespie, and Jack Lee. Huntsville reporter outside the death house, Pat Hartwell. Houston Vigil reporter, Dave Atwood. The execution watch for Manuel Garza Jr. begins.
Good evening. You are listening to Execution Watch. We are gathered here in the KPFT studios as the state of Texas prepares to execute 35-year-old Manuel Garza for the murder of San Antonio SWAT officer John Rocky Riojas. I'm your host, Marlo Blue, filling in for Ray Hill, who is on assignment in Austin, Texas. This evening, we are being joined by Chief Legal Analyst Jim Skelton, legal analysts, Houston criminal defense attorneys, Susan Ashley, Larry Douglas, Michael Gillespie, and Jack Lee. Let's start first, however, with the reporter outside of the death house, Huntsville, Texas, Pat Harwell, an anti-death penalty activist. Pat. Pat.
Hello.
Harwell. Hello, Pat. How are you this evening? This is Marlo.
I'm not good. The test state of Texas is fixing to execute its 524th person. There's about 40 people out here. And if you like, we have, there's about 8 or 9 relatives that are standing outside here. And his brother, Jimmy Gonzalez, would like to say a few words.
I think we'd like to speak with Jimmy Gonzalez, if that's possible. Can you get him to the...
Here he is, right here.
Mr. Gonzalez.
Hello.
Hello, Mr. Gonzalez. Thank you. This is a sad day, and we'd like to know your thoughts about what's about to happen.
Well, my thoughts are—they're simple. Nobody deserves to die. You know, nobody deserves death. Everybody deserves a chance to prove themselves in life, and there comes a time in a man's life where they actually do change. They change the train of thought. You know, they changed their way of life, and it's for the better. For everybody that's on death row, I was never a believer of any of this stuff until today, you know, firmly. My heart goes out to everybody.
Jimmy, when was the last time you saw your brother?
You know, the last time I saw my brother was years ago, and I didn't get to see him because, you know, I was living my life, and I had moved out of state and, you know, raising my family. And, you know, it's not something I regret, but something I do regret is not keeping my life in check and not being able to come see him his last couple of days.
How has this affected your life?
This is going to affect my life every day, you know, every day. He was the only person that I had after my dad left, and now he's gone.
If you could say anything to your brother right now, what would you say?
That I love him, and I'm proud of him. You know, what he did was a total, you know, total mistake and accident. And I'm sorry he never really had a fair trial. You know, I'm sorry I never had the money to put up, you know, to get a better attorney for him.
Jimmy, I know this is a hard time for you. If you don't mind, please put Pat back on the line for us. And we are very sorry for your loss.
Hello?
Pat?
I'm sorry Jimmy had to leave. It's very emotional for the family.
Very emotional.
He's got two sisters and he out here and brother-in-laws and sister-in-laws and cousins and...
Now, of course, it sounds like there are people there who are protesting this particular execution. You say there are about 40 people out there. I hope you're going to let us come back to you after the walk has happened.
Yes, it usually, it's been taking a little bit longer, so maybe 6:37, somewhere around there. The TV crews have showed up. It's
is there a larger...
At least, one thing we can say, the police force of the state of Texas is not revving the motorcycles, which they usually do to disrespect and show their vengeance. They're not doing that tonight, so we're thankful for that.
Well, thank you, Pat. We will be getting back in touch with you a little bit later on in the program. Thank you for that.
Okay, thank you.
Again, we are here this evening at KPFT 90.1 FM in Houston, 89.5 in Galveston, Goodrich, Livingston, 90.3, and, of course, Huntsville at 91.9. If you are behind the walls, know that your voice is heard through KPFT 90.1 FM. Now let's go to a vigil that's here in Houston, Dave Atwood. Dave, this is Marlo Blue. Where are you this evening? Hi.
Well, we're out at in the Museum District. This is where we're going to hold our vigils for the next 3 months, actually, April, May, and June. And we are at the corner of Main and Vin Streets, right across from the Museum of Fine Arts.
Of course, it's not too late to join you. Is that correct?
Right, but they'd have to be in the area probably to make it in time. But we don't have a big group today. We've got about seven people. But, of course, what I always say, the good thing about being down here and other places that we strategically locate is that we literally have hundreds and hundreds of cars go by and see the see our signs, see our banners. And we've been doing this for so many years, I can't remember, but I really do think it has a positive impact on public opinion to see a group of people out here protesting.
Now, of course, you are the founder and a former board member of Texas Coalition to Abolish the Death Penalty. If people would like to be involved in your organization or find out about meetings, other things like that, where do they need to go?
Best way would be to go to the TCADP website, which is tcadp.org, and that will give information on the vigils, the protests, the conferences, educational programs, everything at that TCADP is doing around the state. And, of course, they list there, too, the vigils that are being held in other places in the state and other cities. So it's pretty comprehensive.
And, of course, would you mind telling us what some of the signs say that people are holding up?
Well, stop executions is one. That's the one that we've used quite a bit. One says, respect life, choose life, no death penalty. Another says, an eye for an eye makes the whole world blind. Another one says, execution today. And the big banner says, stop executions. And we have signs that say, don't kill for me. So that's sort of the variety of different signs that we have here and banners.
Well, Dave, thank you for your time today. Are you getting a good response from people as they go past you?
Yeah, we do. I mean, this is what's really amazing. When we first started doing this a long time ago, it was mostly a negative response. Now, most of the responses we get are thumbs up. People toot and give us a thumbs up. Or I had one lady a few minutes ago just roll down the window and thank us for being out here. So it's very positive to see the response. It's totally different than it was, say, 15 years ago.
So things are changing.
Yep, they are.
Well, Dave Atwood, thank you so much for your time today. We appreciate all that you do, and thank you for being our eyes and ears at the vigil here in Houston, Texas. Again, if anybody wants to contact you, that website is?
TCADP.org.
Very good. Thank you again, Dave.
All righty. You take care. Bye-bye.
You are listening to Execution Watch right here on 90.1 FM in Houston. The time is now 6:10. If you are tuning in for Border Radio with Susan, it will return next week on Wednesday in its regularly scheduled time. I'm Marlo Blue filling in for Ray Hill. Let me introduce our chief legal analyst right now, Jim Skelton. Jim, thank you for being here tonight. Give us a little bit of an overview of this case.
What happened? This came out of San Antonio, and there's a 37-year-old police officer named John Riojas. I guess it's R-I-O-J-O-S, mm-hmm. Riojas, and he has been native of San Antonio, lived there all his life, went to school, and he was a member of the SWAT team in San Antonio Police Department. And he was on patrol one night, and he was patrolling an area in San Antonio that had a lot of burglars reported and things of that nature. And as he was patrolling, he saw Manuel Garza on the street. Now, the opinions do not say anything about why they drew his attention to him. They just saw him on the street in that area that's a high-crime area. And at that point, he gets out and, I say confront, man, might be the right word, but he gets out and approaches him. Let me explain some law at this point. Anybody, there's nothing wrong with a police officer approaching somebody in a public place. There's absolutely nothing wrong with that. But he hasn't got the right to detain somebody unless he has some reasonable belief they're breaking the law. But it doesn't say anything about that in the opinion. All it says is that he approached Rios, and Rocky approached him, and wanted his identification. And the problem was, unknown to him, Manuel Garza had some active arrest warrants for a burglary of a motor vehicle to him, as a matter of fact. And he obviously, from his statement, said he didn't want to get arrested. So he gave a false name, and at this point, the opinions don't really say, at least when the case was developed in court. At this point, Garza starts running away from the police officer. Police officer gives chase, catches him, and once he catches him, there's kind of two different versions of what happened. He catches him, and during the struggle, Garza manages to get the police officer's gun and shoots him once square in the head and kills him. There were two eyewitnesses to this, and what they basically said was as follows, and this seems to be logical what occurred. They said that the officer had, from behind, was trying to get a headlock on Garza, and that Garza, with his left hand, reached down and grabbed the officer's service revolver out of his holster, put it over his right shoulder, turned his head to one side, and fired one shot, which happened to hit him in the head. And after the police officer got hit in the head, of course, with that type of wound, he fell over immediately. At that point, Garza runs to an apartment complex where some friends of his lived. And at the apartment complex, of course, he was kind of bruised up and had some bruises around his neck from struggling with the police officer. He tried to explain that he had been in a fight. And it was his girlfriend's, one of his friends' apartment. And the next morning, when his friends read about the shooting, they called the police. And that's how it led to him. And another thing that really hurt him, he also went to his girlfriend's house to her brother and tried to sell him the officer's gun for $100 plus an amplifier. So 2 days later, he's arrested. And at that point, he gives two written statements, and he doesn't help himself very much in the written statements. Because for the first statement, he simply said, I did this because I didn't want to go back to jail. And he tried to claim the police officer drew the gun first, and that he took the gun away from the police officer. That's kind of hard to believe because the police officer had been a linebacker football player at high school, was big husky, member of the SWAT team, and the likelihood of him jerking the gun from the police officer's hands, probably not true.
Right. He wasn't just a police officer. He was a member of a very elite SWAT team.
Absolutely.
He was in excellent physical condition.
Absolutely. And what the witnesses say, there were two witnesses. One was standing up on a balcony and looked down at it, and one came up as the shooting occurred, and both witnesses said just what I'd said earlier, that the officer had him trying to get him a headlock from behind. Garza reaches around, grabs his pistol, shoots him once in the head. And so those statements didn't help him in what he tried to argue, and I thought the court was gratuitous about it. They did give him a self-defense charge. And all the lawyers and I talked about this earlier, and self-defense doesn't exist in this case for several reasons. Number one, to claim self-defense, the other person that's shot has to be the aggressor, and he's got to do something unlawful. In other words, the law says you must be under an unlawful attack by somebody using deadly force. Police officer didn't have his gun drawn. There's no claim of excessive force. And you're entitled to shoot somebody under those conditions, but he was not under an unlawful attack by the police officer because he ran away from the police officer. And self-defense was not obviously a good defense. Plus, he also claimed during some of his statements that it was an accident and claimed the gun had a hair trigger. Well, the problem with that, they had a ballistics expert test the gun. And trigger pull is the amount of pressure you have to do to pull a trigger. The normal pressure pull this was a Glock, is about 5.5 pounds. This gun had an 8-pound trigger pull, which means took a lot more strength to pull the trigger. Did not have a hair trigger. And that pretty well sank him. In fact, his defense, what he said was so feeble, took the jury 1 hour to convict him and just 3 hours to give him the death penalty.
And yet this was a very high-profile case in San Antonio, wasn't it?
Well, anytime you shoot a police officer, it's pretty high-profile.
Right. The time is now 6:15. You are listening to Execution Watch right here on 90.1 FM in Houston, 89.5 in Galveston, and, of course, in Huntsville at 91.9. Let's move on a little bit later. Susan Ashley, tell us a little bit about, if you don't mind, the evidence that was presented at punishment in this case.
The punishment evidence came out along these lines. The Garza was only 20 years old at the time of the offense, but at the age of 20, he had 14 arrests as an adult. So the state, of course, brought that out. He had 3 juvenile convictions for robbery, burglary, and drugs, and he was sent to TYC. At the time of the offense, he had 5 outstanding warrants. He had 7 outstanding warrants, but he had 5 cases that involved either evading arrest, resisting arrest, or giving a false name to a police officer. And I guess he had 5 outstanding warrants, and 2 were for burglary of a motor vehicle. So, of course, the state was able to bring that out. At trial, the defense presented, shall we say, limited mitigation evidence. They put on the testimony of 3 lay people, those people being his uncle, his mother, and his sister. And those were family members. Those family members testified that the family was, shall we say, crime-ridden. There was a lot of crime in the family, that the family was unstable, that the father was abusive, and that essentially it was kind of a troubled family, not a very good background. However, they also said that the mother was good and the mother was caring and she loved her son. They also gave, those 3 family members gave their opinion that Garza would not be a future danger to society. So the defense also put on when Garza went to TYC, there were psychological evaluations done of him in 96, 97, and 98. So the defense put on the psychological evaluations that had been done as evidence in the case. The psychological evaluations, I guess you could say that they were not really extremely negative, but they weren't that positive either. The psychological evaluations came to the conclusion that he had a negative attitude towards authority, that he had difficulty internalizing society's values, that he was impulsive, that he was a gang member and prone to antisocial behavior. This was put on by the defense, and it probably didn't help very much, but maybe that's all they really had. The defense also engaged a psychological expert, Dr. Farrell, to do an evaluation of Garza. They engaged the expert. Dr. Farrell did do an evaluation of Garza, but Dr. Farrell did not testify at trial. Later, at the writ hearing, there was a writ hearing, and on the post-conviction writ, Garza alleged that the defense counsel was ineffective, that they failed to investigate and develop evidence of his childhood abuse, neglect, what a poor background he had, and that they should have developed that evidence and presented it at trial. That was one main issue that he complained of on the writ. At the writ hearing, Dr. Farrell was called to testify, and actually there were three. Dr. Farrell was called to testify, and another expert, Dr. Kate Allen, also testified. Now, both these experts at the writ hearing kind of give what I call kind of problematic testimony. Dr. Farrell apparently testifies at first that had he been called, he would have said that Garza was not a future danger to society, but he went on to say that he had concerns, and he had concerns about the absence of dangerousness, and that he was not given a complete package of information on Garza, and that had he gotten the complete package of information that he later got from defense counsel, that he would not be able to testify that Garza was not a future danger. Mm. So he indicated, Dr. Farrell indicated to the defense lawyer that he was not going to be able to testify that Garza was not a future danger. So the defense lawyer, of course, did not call Dr. Farrell as a mitigation in the punishment phase of the trial. Dr. Kate Allen also did an evaluation of Garza. She testified at the writ hearing that she was not qualified or giving an opinion on future dangerousness was beyond her scope of expertise. And so she had a test. There were certain factors she considered a risk factor, and there were other factors she considered to be protective factors. So one would assume she has sort of a balancing test,
right,
of different factors. Well, she initially concluded that he wasn't violent, but she said that he had more risk factors than protective factors in the kind of test analysis she was using. Hmm. She also went on to say that she was not given complete information on him and that she failed to take into account his previous convictions, other, you know, acts of him fighting gang activity. And strangely enough, she said she never met him. So, go figure. Okay, it does seem kind of odd to me that she would have never met him, but that's what she said. She never met him. So, the end result was that, the court basically concluded that both these doctor experts that testified at the writ hearing, that their analysis had limited credibility, and it was based on, incomplete information. And when they got more complete information, their opinions changed.
Right.
So, the court, of course, concluded that, their testimony would not have changed the outcome of the case and probably would not have helped. Defense also engaged another mitigation expert, and that expert basically advised them to bring out his bad background, essentially to try to create sympathy for him. Mm-hmm. There was another issue that Garza raised in a post-conviction writ. He said that the defense should have investigated and developed fetal alcohol syndrome. Now, the only time this came up was at the writ hearing, because there was no defense counsel, had no, this issue was not raised in anything in his past, nothing in the TYC evaluations. It was not raised by Garza in the past. It was just something he brought up at the writ hearing. So, of course, this would be something that it wouldn't be reasonable for defense counsel to think about something that nobody has ever raised and was not in his record. So, of course, naturally, the court, was of the opinion that there was no ineffective assistance and there was nothing in the previous record to give any hint of fetal alcohol syndrome.
Very interesting, yeah. The time is now 6:24. You are listening to Execution Watch here on KPFT 90.1 FM. Larry Douglas, let's go to you. Let's talk a little bit about the jury and what was presented to them.
We just want to talk for a few minutes just about the defense of self-defense. Jim's already mentioned before that, in Texas, self-defense is a very, can be, under the right set of facts, a very effective defense. Texas has a fairly strong self-defense statute. And you might remember that years ago there was an inmate in prison by the name of Eroy Brown, who prison officials actually tried to murder him in prison. And so he used self-defense effectively to get a not guilty verdict, because it's just common sense. If somebody's trying unjustifiably, criminally, to take action against you, including trying to kill you, then the Texas law allows you to use the reasonable amount of force that you believe in your mind is necessary to protect yourself, up to and including deadly force. So Jim's mentioned that, you know, there was the question was presented to the jury regarding self-defense. Well, Garza went a little bit further and tried to use the theory of first aggressor, saying that Officer Rios was the first aggressor. Now, he was trying to use Officer Rios's tendency toward violence, since we know he was a linebacker as high school, and he was a member of the SWAT team, and he was in real good shape, and he was a boxer, thus the name Rocky. So he's a pretty tough guy. But you just can't start bringing that stuff into court unless there's some justification for bringing it in. And so not just claim that, you know, he acted in conformity with that reputation, even though Garza didn't know about the reputation, without there being some showing that there was some illegal first aggression on his part. Unlike the Eroy Brown situation, where they were actually, prison officials were actually trying to murder him, Garza didn't have any of that. You know, all he had was a young kid running from the police himself, running from the police because he didn't want to go back to jail, according to him. And then there was a struggle between him and the police officer, and all the police officer's trying to do, not exercising any excessive force, but just trying to effect a legal arrest. That's all the police officer is trying to do. So as a result, the evidence that they sought to introduce regarding Officer Rios's character toward being a propensity to violence, that just was, I think, correctly excluded by the court. But he did get the jury instruction regarding self-defense. It didn't work because the facts of the case just seemed not to show that he was justified by any stretch of the imagination, using the defense of self-defense.
Again, it is 6:28. You are listening to Execution Watch right here on 90.1 FM. My understanding is that the U.S. Supreme Court did refuse any last appeal, so we are assuming that this execution for Manuel Garza is continuing. Garza will be the sixth convicted killer put to death this year in Texas. Of course, Texas carries out more death penalty convictions than any other state, and Garza will be the first inmate executed with a new small supply of phenobarbital that was recently obtained by Texas prison officials. Mike Gillespie, at the writ hearings, Garza argued that trial counsel failed to introduce two pieces of evidence, prior inconsistent statements made by one of the state witnesses and medical records allegedly supporting the theory that Garza acted in self-defense. Can you discuss that a little bit for us?
The law provides that a man is allowed to have an attorney. But more than that, the law provides that the man is allowed to have a competent attorney. This test was set out by the United States Supreme Court in a landmark case called Strickland versus the United States. That case has also been approved in Texas under the case of Henderson versus the state of Texas. That is a two-prong test, which means you got to make two prongs to it. The first prong is you have to prove that the defendant must demonstrate that the attorney's performance was deficient. Secondly, he also must prove that not only was the standard deficient, but there would have been a difference in the result if it was not deficient. In this case, as you said, there was two things he complained about his lawyer about. That number one, there was a prior inconsistent statement by a lady named Henderson. And the second thing was there were medical records that were not introduced. Let's talk about Ms. Henderson first. Ms. Henderson testified on the witness stand that she saw an altercation, a fight, between Mr. Garza and the police officer. She also testified that she saw that Garza had possession of the gun. She also said that she saw and heard a gunshot. She also testified that she did not see the police officer's hand near the gun when fired. Well, that's pretty strong evidence against Mr. Garza. The problem was that before the trial, she gave a different statement to the defense investigator. And during that statement, what she stated is that the shooting might have been an accident. Now,
again, for those of you who may have just been joining us and looking for Border Radio, Susan will be returning next week. The time is now 6:30. You are listening to Execution Watch here on 90.1 FM and, of course, always on the World Wide Web at KPFT.org. So what else, Mike?
Well, at first blush, you would begin to imagine, well, why could not this investigator come in and tell the court about a prior inconsistent statement that this witness made? Well, the reason they don't allow it is because she admitted that she had made a prior inconsistent statement. So therefore, if she admits she made a prior inconsistent statement, the law does not provide for the investigator to come in and talk about it. She said what happened. She admitted she made a prior inconsistent statement. All that evidence was before the court. And so therefore, under the Texas rules of evidence, that investigator was not allowed to testify. He could only testify to impeach her, which means to show that she was lying. Well, she wasn't lying. She admitted she made a prior inconsistent statement. The jury has got the right to look at these statements and decide what the truth is. The second thing, what happened, was that he argued that the lawyer should have introduced medical records to show there was a struggle, to show there was a fight. Well, the problem with that is that the medical records were introduced, but there was no evidence to show that any bruises or injuries was caused by the police officer. Just because it was injuries does not mean that that is some kind of self-defense claim. The evidence clearly shows, the medical records, that there were some injuries, but there was nothing showing that those injuries came from something the police officer was doing wrong. More importantly than that, the defendant's own statement, he did not claim any kind of abuse by this officer or being hit by this officer. What he had admitted was that he was trying to get away. So his own statement shows that it was not a struggle that was caused by some kind of force by the officer. Rather, he was trying to get away from the officer. So again, under Texas rules of evidence, just because there was injuries, he could not link up the injuries from the police officer to blame the police officer from it. All of these issues are Texas evidentiary law. And what evidentiary law in Texas is the rules we put into effect to make sure that the evidence coming forth in the courtroom are competent evidence. Our laws clearly say these are not admissible. The federal courts, when they look at the writ, has to look at Texas statutory law, and the statutory law says they're not admissible. So what the court held is you can't blame the lawyer for not coming to court with evidence that's not admissible. That's not his fault. And so based upon that, they said there is no Strickland violation, and based on that, the lawyer did not do anything wrong. More than that, they never really got to the issue as to whether or not this evidence would have made a difference in the case.
So we're talking about basically deficient legal help, how that made a difference, the things that are going on. The time is now 6:34. You are listening to Execution Watch here on 90.1 FM in Houston, 89.5 in Galveston, 90.3 in Goodrich, Livingston, and 91.9 in Huntsville, Texas. We are waiting to hear from our reporter, Pat Hartwell, who is outside of the death house in Huntsville, to find out what the status is going on death row in Huntsville. For the moment, let's go ahead and talk a little bit about this case with Jack Lee. Jack.
Hi. I wanted to discuss the what Garza said about his the ineffectiveness of his attorneys at trial, and as it relates to how the appeal went, how the appeal to federal district court and then to the Fifth Circuit and ultimately to the Supreme Court. The problem, what Garza was saying was that his attorneys at the trial level, among other things, didn't ask the jury very specific questions about how they felt about the death penalty, how they situations involving murder and the death penalty, things like mercy, self-defense, guns and gun ownership, the juror's obligation to be fair and impartial. He even went so far as to complain that his trial attorneys didn't ask the juries about probability. Now, these are all interesting questions. Unfortunately, they don't really get to the point, they don't rise to the level of making this appealable as a federal case. Because a state habeas petitioner has to show at the very least that there's a substantial showing of a denial of a constitutional right. Probability asking a jury about probability is not a constitutional right, nor is questions about the juror's obligation to be fair questions about self-defense. These aren't delineated constitutional rights. Furthermore, that's to get to a district court. And here in this situation, the district court looked at it and said, you know what, we are denying you a certification of appeal. We're not going to certify this to appeal, so we're not seeing this as a federal case. When you appeal it to to the Fifth Circuit, you have the additional hurdle that there has to be a debatable issue, meaning that there has to be a legal issue which the district court got wrong, or that there's unsettled law. Suppose there's law that differs from what the district court said, say in the Second Circuit. The easiest way to achieve this second point is if there's, say, an issue that's not been settled by a different court, or very rarely, in fact, we've never seen this before, a misinterpretation of the facts. This second part is highly unlikely. What he's looking for, frankly, is he's trying to pin something on the trial attorneys, and frankly, God bless the appellate attorneys. They were really struggling to come up with something to go out on appeal, and this was really the trial attorneys did a pretty good job. They did such a good job, in fact, that the appellate attorneys didn't have much to go on. So few stones had been left unturned, they were looking at overturning pebbles.
Is this unusual?
No. It's unfortunate. Most trial attorneys on death penalty cases, frankly, they do a very good job. And the appellate attorneys are left with, frankly, not much to work with. And so that's why you have so many appeals based upon ineffective counsel when there really wasn't. It's about the only thing that you can throw at the case.
Hmm. Now, my understanding is this case was important for an aspect that the legislator actually took it up and increased the penalty for taking an officer's weapon. Is it that much of a special case?
Well, unfortunately, we're so
a problem to law and order. Anytime you kill a policeman, every prosecutor in the world is going to seek the death penalty because they have a big voting block. And it's more political, I think, than it is anything. Because, for example, there's a policeman killed here in town. The elected DA always wants to try it to get their name in the paper and get elected. And anytime you kill a police officer, so many people, every third person in the state has a badge. They all go gaga because some police officer got shot. And this, truthfully, is probably not a death penalty case. It's sad because this officer left an eight-week-old baby, girl, and a young son. It's very tragic. But every murder is that way. There's not, the only difference between this and a regular murder is a badge. And that's very political when you start shooting police officers. Because they vote, and they get out and vote real well, and they get to elect all these yahoos who make the law.
Of course, the time is now 6:40. You are listening to Execution Watch here on 90.1 FM. I am here with Jim Skelton, Larry Douglas, Susan Ashley, Mike Gillespie, and Jack Lee. We are awaiting Pat Hartwell, our reporter from outside of the death house, to call to let us know what the status is of Manuel Garza. Tell us a little bit more, Jim.
Let me tell you, this case is probably a great illustration. Every case we discuss, we've discussed thousands.
Right.
They always have ineffective assistance of counsel. And one thing we need to do and the public needs to know is the restraints that a defense lawyer works with. As a matter of fact, they had some guy from California, some law professor is going to blast Texas law as not being effective. And I wanted to jump on him. Ray said I couldn't. Mm-hmm. But I said, if you brought a California lawyer working with the constraints that we, California lawyer working with the constraints that we have in Texas, you would be no more effective. Let me give you some examples. In Texas, the general rule is that the judge sitting on the bench had been the DA the day before, and the prosecutor has been somebody they hired before. As a matter of fact, the judiciary is a retirement program for the DA's office. In Harris County, we have, 20-something district court judges? Virtually all of them but two or three are former DAs. Some of them went straight from the DA's office to the bench.
You have one who used to be a traffic court
judge.
Appeal judge.
And so what happens, you have these judges that, and the reason they get there, because they're at the bottom of the pool, they can't make any money. So you end up getting people, and I'll give you a good example. You get up getting people who really are prosecuting from the bench. And we've had instances where judges have texted prosecutors during the trial on what questions to ask. It happened up in Livingston. And what we ended up with are our judges. I'll give you a good example. We've got a judge here in Brown named Susan Brown. She's got the face of a rat and the heart of Hannibal Lecter. And trying to get a fair trial on her is a big joke. And I don't care what the lawyer is.
Don't sugarcoat it, Jim.
Well, I
don't sugarcoat
it. You couldn't sugarcoat that, believe me. She looks like bottom half of a peeled scab is the nicest thing I can say for her, and her heart's cold as the dickens. Anyway, that's what you get in front of. You get in center front of. You're not only fighting the prosecutor, you're fighting the judge, too, because they're in bed with one another. Now, and it's hard to get a real fair trial. You have to go to a jury, and it's hard to get a real fair. We got some good judges, don't get me wrong. Only as bad as she is. She just happens to be the worst of the group that we're talking about. But even I can say in most of these little counties that you try cases in Harris County, there are prosecutors that have never done fence law, have never had a problem representing people, have no earthly idea what the world's like. So you get that as a trial level. Now, here's what happens. Once you get convicted, you go back on a post-conviction where you can develop the lawyer being effective. And guess what judge you have? The same judge you heard the trial to begin with. And that judge at the writ hearing, what he dictates is being factual, and what they call it findings of facts, conclusions of law, that's what the federal court's bound by unless there's some type of constitutional violation that they overlooked. So what that means is it's kind of like getting in a fight with your wife, and guess who the judge is judging? Your mother-in-law. And that's what it ends up being. And those writ hearings are pretty well rigged because I'll guarantee you in a majority of the writ hearings, the prosecutor is the one that submits the findings of facts, conclusions of law, and the judge signs off on them. And really, say that they get a fair hearing at a writ hearing is stupid. What they should do is have a different judge from a different jurisdiction handle the writ hearing. Because if the trial judge heard it, he's already heard all the evidence. He's got his mind made up ahead of time. You can have Christ from heaven come down and testify. He's not going to change that. And that's terribly unfair. So what happens, you're going to have a real difficult time getting a fair trial at trial because you've got a prosecutor sitting on the bench in most cases and a prosecutor from apart from you because they work together every day. Then secondly, you go to the writ hearing part, and you have the same judge who heard the trial that makes the determination on what happens. They make the determination of who's telling the truth, and they make findings of facts that the federal court's bound by so long as a record supports what that judge thinks. And that's terribly, terribly, terribly unfair. Then you end up having to go to the court, and then you file a writ to go into federal court. That is not a true writ, because in federal court, what they say, they look at the decision made by the trial judge in state court, and they ask this question. Is it an unfair application of law as interpreted by the Supreme Court? And they can't question the factual findings made by that state judge in writ court. And so what happens, 90% of those are flushed down the tube. And it's not the lawyers that are ineffective. The procedures that we have to work under is what makes them ineffective. Example, and no, remember when Iris Siff, the lady down at the Alley Theater, was strangled to death? The state spent a ton of money on getting experts. They limited the defense lawyer's expert to something like $800. And it's not a fair fight because the state can produce tons of experts, and they're going to really gripe it. You go to a judge wanting an expert appointed in a death penalty case, very few of them are going to accommodate you. And we have some good judges. Don't get me wrong, all of them are not bad. We've got some good ones. But they're in the minority because here's the problem. And anybody who's been around this town long enough knows this. Back when Carol Vance was the DA, there was a camaraderie between the defense bar and the prosecutors. We all worked together. We all knew each other. Most of our enemies were the judges. We spent all of our time trying to kill the judge. And then when Johnny Holmes comes along, he would rather be a cop than a lawyer. And what happened, there was a marriage between the police department and the DA's office. As a matter of fact, most of the investigators were former policemen. They put DA's intake in the police department, DA's intake in the DA's office. And the Holmes group became a law firm for the police department. This is why people should be complaining of all the murders we've had in Houston, of cops killing people. Not one of them have ever been indicted. And you know why? Because the DA's office represents the police department, not the public.
Jim, thank you. Let's take a break right now and head back out to Huntsville, where Pat Hartwell says that the witnesses have already come out of the death house. We'll be getting her on the line shortly. Again, you are listening to Execution Watch, where we believe that the execution of 35-year-old Manuel Garza has taken place. We will be going to Pat Hartwell. She is our reporter from the death house in Huntsville. As soon as we get her back on the line, Manuel is the 524th execution in Texas since the death penalty was reinstated in 1976. Manuel Garza was 34. And he was convicted for the murder of San Antonio police officer John Rocky Riojas. Again, you are listening to Execution Watch. I'm here with Jim Skelton, with Susan Ashley, with Mike Gillespie, and Jack Lee. While we try and get Pat Hartwell back onto the phone, let's continue our discussion.
One other thing I failed to mention, and this to me is just ludicrous, and
I apologize. We do have Pat Hartwell on the line now. Pat.
Yes.
Have the witnesses come back out?
Yes, they came and I waited on the line for about 5 minutes and had to get off. I'm with the family. They've come across, so we know that it's over with.
And how many of the family members are you there with?
About eight.
It is over.
It's over. The state of Texas has accomplished what they set out to accomplish. This is 524 for the state of Texas and number 6 for Greg Abbott.
Number 6. Thank you so much, Pat, for your reporting. We appreciate it.
Do you want to say anything to Jimmy, the brother?
I think we'll just keep moving on. And please send him our best wishes and our condolences And our condolences to the rest of the family as well.
Okay. Thank you
so much. Jim.
And one thing I want to mention that's just ludicrous is the trial structure itself. For example, it's two phases in a capital murder case. First phase is guilt or innocence. Now, once you found somebody guilty, what the jury basically said, this man has committed a heinous crime because capital murder is reserved for heinous crimes. You know what the next thing they ask them?
What?
Would that person be a future danger? Well, if you committed the heinous crime they found him guilty of, that's an almost automatic yes, by virtue of the fact that they found him guilty of a crime that deserves, a statute state that deserves the death penalty, they're obviously going to find him future dangerous.
Well, now, of course, Susan was talking earlier about no future danger to society. How did we go from simply being a car thief? And suspected of burglary, auto theft, and marijuana possession.
A badge. Pretty simple. Now, for example, in the federal system, the capital murder case they're trying now, they don't ask that stupid question about future dangers to society. What they ask is as following. Number one, look at all the aggravating facts, the bad things, police officer, somebody killed, in the line of duty. Number two, look at the mitigating factors that this kid lived with. He's a 20-year-old kid using the judgment of a 20-year-old kid that was raised in a poor part of San Antonio without much family support and gets involved with gangs, which most kids that age do. And how would anybody like their life dictated by decisions they made when they're 20 years old? So like in the federal system, what they do, they say, what we do, jury, is what you got to do. You got to weigh the aggravating part of the crime with the mitigating factors. And here's one of the problems with the mitigating factors. When you start proving somebody has got a mental problem or somebody's got a personality problem, there's also an incentive to put that person out of society because they're afraid of him. For example, when you claim a person is slow and retarded, you can't fix that. Now, you elect them a judge, that fixes them, but other short of that, you can't fix mental retardation.
I want to ask you all a question because, you know, killing cops is always making the headlines, but lately, the headlines have been going about cop killings on the rise, or are they just more in the headlines now?
People are videoing it for the first time. The killing, if you recall, when the man got shot in the back, and here's what's kind of outrageous. When he got shot in the back, they watched the police officer plant a laser next to the body. And what's even more outrageous, one of the cops already filed an offense report claiming that the guy was acting in self-defense. He had pulled a laser on the cop, lied through his teeth. And the offense report, they've already proven that. And the reason that there's not an increase in police killing, there's an increase in video cameras that have caught these people lying. And if we'd had video cameras earlier, we'd have more of these type of cases. Because every case you see where someone's get fired, it's irrefutable evidence. Because my biggest complaint about the police, my biggest complaint, and I'll say this over and over again, they will not clean up their own house. When a police officer does something wrong, they have an obligation to protect him. If you're going to enforce the law, you should enforce the law at home to begin with. And they're not enforcing because they want to. They're getting forced to get caught on video. The difference in today's society and what happened 5 years ago is video cameras. And thank God, I hope they put video cameras, especially on narcotics cops. I'd love to see what those liars have to say.
It should be the world's about to change.
I hope that's why it's
really
not an increase.
It really does seem about to change.
We just caught them for the first time.
You know, you were talking about Johnny Holmes a little bit ago. Mm-hmm. What about our new, well, she's not new anymore, but D.A. Anderson. What is her shop like?
Well, she's not as ugly as Johnny. It's about the best I can say.
She didn't wear a white hat.
Do what? But she's the same old routine. She gets in the DA's office. She goes in the DA's office to the bench.
Yeah.
From the bench, she gets kicked out and practices law for a little bit. Then she marries Mike Anderson, becomes the DA. And she's, for example, a lot of stuff that Pat Likas did was, I thought, pretty inventive. Like, for example, taking small amounts of marijuana and not putting people in prison. She changed that policy. They're still doing these trace amount cases at Pat Likas. And the reason why they're doing them, because the cops got mad about it. Because that's great low-hanging fruit. Mm-hmm. You can build up your police record by arresting some dodo with a crack pipe. And that doesn't really solve anything. And Likas started treating that as a Class C misdemeanor, what it should have been. And that's one of the reasons she got defeated. Because she wasn't one of those law and order folks that what we currently have now. And I don't think she's an improvement at all.
Judge Likas also instituted a program where first-time DWI offenders would basically get on probation, and if you behaved and you learned your lesson, they'd cut you loose. They'd dismiss the case. The new DA simply took it, renamed it, and rinse, repeat.
Rinse, repeat, indeed. It's hard to believe that with the short period of time that Greg Abbott has been in office, there have already been 6 executions here in the state of Texas. And, of course, next week there is a scheduled execution. It's Richard Vasquez on Thursday, April the 23rd. If the state of Texas does carry that out, Execution Watch will be on the airwaves on 90.1 FM, 89.5 in Galveston, 90.3 Goodrich Livingston, and Huntsville 91.9, starting again at 6 p.m. You are listening to Execution Watch. I do want to thank everybody who's been a part of this show. Of course, here in the studio is Jim Skelton, Larry Douglas, Susan Ashley, Mike Gillespie, and Jack Lee. We've also had reports coming in from Pat Hartwell, who is our reporter outside of the Death House, and TCADP past founder, founder and former board member David Atwood, who has been talking to us from the Houston Vigil here in the Museum District. A lot of information to digest, absolutely. Again, Texas has executed the 524th person in Texas since 1976 when the death penalty was reinstated. That is Manuel Garza. We don't have the time of death, but the execution has been carried out. Do you have any final words, Jim?
Don't sugarcoat it.
Well, let Susan talk about it a bit.
Well, going back to the punishment phase of a trial, I would basically say this, that lawyers can develop evidence that's there. There has to be something there to develop. Lawyer cannot manufacture it out of thin air. Mm. Okay? And like the example is, okay, his bad background, well, that might be something they develop in many capital murder cases. But the claim of fetal alcohol syndrome at the writ phase, where nothing, zero, was there, it's kind of, you know, like manufacturing it when it just wasn't there. Mm-hmm. So lawyer has to have something to work with and to develop. Also, lawyer will hire the best experts that their side of the case can afford. And in this case, Dr. Farrell, for some reason he was not given everything to start with, which is kind of hard to understand. And also Dr. Allen never even visited him.
An amazing story. Again, this is Execution Watch. I am your substitute host, Marlo Blue. Ray Hill will be returning to Execution Watch. Thank you, Jim Skelton, Larry Douglas, Susan Ashley, Mike Gillespie, and Jack Lee, Pat Hartwell, Dave Atwood. Join us again on Thursday, April the 23rd, for the vigil, the electronic vigil for Richard Vasquez. Coming up next is Arab Voices.
Some get good lawyers, most don't. State of Texas, killing machines.